You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 14th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
How we doing?
Good. Pretty good.
Super.
Yeah, fine.
So, Evan, December 17th, huh?
The year was 1919.
Albert Porta, a respected American meteorologist, whose last name means door in Italian, I believe. Well, he caused a widespread panic back in 1919, and he predicted that a conjunction of six planets, which was to occur on December 17th, would blast the Earth into oblivion. So apparently what was going to happen is that this conjunction of the six planets was going to cause a magnetic current that would pierce the sun and cause a great explosion of flaming gas and engulf the Earth. Bye-bye, Earth. And people took this quite seriously. As after all, he was a respected American meteorologist, so he had some sway with the public.
Mm-hmm.
There's reports of, some mob riots and even a few suicides, reportedly.
Wow.
Based on this particular prediction he made. And, of course, it didn't happen, and then his reputation crashed and burned right after that, and nobody took him seriously.
The suicide thing always boggles my mind, because if the world were to end, then why kill yourself before it happens, you know?
Yeah. I'd want to see it happening. What a way to go, huh?
In some people's version of the end time, so it's not something you really want to stick around for. There's locusts and horsemen.
But it never occurred to them he might be wrong, you know? the stakes don't get higher.
Yeah, but what gets me about this stuff is that people never consider, hey, I wonder if this has happened before. And if you kind of look at when these types of groupings have happened, like, say, for four more planets lining up, it happens like every 57 years. So, hello, I mean, that's kind of pertinent information that seems like a lot of these people never consider. And I know he was going off on magnetism and stuff, which is really silly. But a lot of people focus on the gravitational increase. And if you line up five planets and look at what the effect on the gravitational pull, I think it's less than 1% increase. I mean, if I just step really close to you, I'm having more of an effect than the five planets would have. It's just so silly.
Do you remember the planetary alignment in 1982?
Big. Yes.
May? Is it May 5th?
March 10th.
I thought it was
May. That's close.
Oh, yeah. I think you're right.
March 10th. You know what that's called when the planets line up?
Is it syzygy?
Syzygy.
Yes.
Syzygy technically is when three bodies line up, like the sun, the earth, and the moon, but it's also sort of more loosely used to refer to planets. Although they weren't all lined up, they were just all on the same side of the sun at one time.
Kind of a loose alignment.
Yeah, so-called grand syzygy. The next one is coming up May 19th, 2161, when all of the planets will be within 69 degrees of each other.
Wow. There was a six-planet cluster that just this past May, in fact.
But, Evan, no effect on earthquakes?
No effect. No effect on earthquakes.
Rebecca, you guys over at Skeptic wrote about a new children's book about the wonderful world of measles.
Yeah, it's actually it's a great new children's book, and it's inspired us to put out a whole new series of books based on the same idea. So, for instance, our first title is going to be Syphilis. Awesome. and it's going to
Syphilis. Look what it did for Hitler.
Right. It's going to teach kids to have unprotected sex because syphilis is not as bad as everybody says it is. And then teach them ways that they can get it and, basically tell them that it's totally cool and a healthy thing to do. And it's really not that big of a deal.
I'm looking forward to the sequel, Playing with Polio.
Yep. It's going to be a great series. And I'm sure no one can think of anything that could possibly go wrong with that. Yeah, that's the book that Stephanie Messenger has written. It's called Melanie's Marvelous Measles. And it is written for children to teach them that measles are a wonderful thing to get, that you don't need to get a vaccination. that you can just contract measles and it's really not that big of a deal and it'll make you much healthier and everybody, it's natural, you know. There's a little girl chasing a butterfly on the cover. I'm pretty sure that's how measles works. You chase butterflies when you get it.
What doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
It's kind of like those herpes commercials where everybody just looks so goddamn happy and you think, maybe I've been missing out, you know, by not having herpes.
You're missing out on something.
It's the same sort of thing. Like she just looks really happy to have measles. So Stephanie Messenger is obviously an anti-vaxxer. She's friends with Meryl Dorey of AVN. We've talked about her before. Yeah. Meryl Dorey's the really outrageously awful woman who is anti-vaccine. She's an HIV AIDS denialist. So they're both in Australia. Messenger has a really sad backstory. Her child died very young. She blames it on vaccines. There's really no way to tell, you know, what exactly happened there. You only have her anecdote to go by. So,
well, I could say though that the story of what happened to her child is pretty typical of certain classes of neurodegenerative diseases, like the so-called leukodystrophies. There are some people who think that her child may have had Alexander disease. We can't know that. But essentially, these children progress normally for 1 to 2 years, and then their nervous system starts to break down because of a genetic problem. And then they begin to regress, and they you know, eventually die. The story of what happened to her child fits that very well. So we don't know that, but that's certainly a plausible alternative. We could be reasonably sure it wasn't a vaccine that did it, but that's what she has assumed.
Yeah, and apparently she once mentioned that the doctors thought that it might have been Alexander's disease. She uses her other children as examples of to support her view because her other children do not have. They were never vaccinated, and she says that they are perfectly healthy. A commenter on Respectful Insolence actually mentioned that those children are the children of a different father than the other ones, which supports the idea that this might have been a genetic disease. So, yeah, there are a lot of maybes, but you know, there is one thing we do know for sure, and that's that vaccines are safe and effective, and we are all much better off when everyone is getting vaccinated. Children,
not what I read.
in Melanie's Marvelous Measles.
Yeah.
Children like Stephanie Messenger's children are benefiting from herd immunity. They're benefiting from the fact that everyone else is getting vaccinated, which is protecting them. Unfortunately, herd immunity is dropping, which is why we're seeing measles coming back. Measles can actually kill and maim in ways that are not mentioned in Melanie's Marvelous Measles. Oddly
Join
enough.
The herd.
So yeah, that's what's happening. This book is being self-published, so there's no publisher to complain about or to boycott. Unfortunately, it looks like as of right now, she's able to get away with just publishing this absolute dreck focused on children who will read this and not know any better. They'll read this and think that, oh, okay, there's nothing harmful about measles. It's perfectly natural and fun to get measles.
Well, what good is an insane belief without some propaganda to back it up?
Yeah, and you know, we all know that the best way to spread a belief like that is to get kids when they're young, when they're not necessarily going to question your authority. So yeah, it's a savvy decision on the part of Messenger.
I feel bad for her. I mean, she lost a child. It's got to be such an incredibly horrific life-altering event, and you know, maybe she feels like she's trying to do some good and everything. And it's so sad and common for us to see people like fall into like the single anecdote. Well, you know, this was my only child that got sick. All the other ones are fine, and a lot of people definitely, you know, buy into that. They don't have any perspective on the fact that that single anecdote or personal experience that they have is just completely worthless. Like, it doesn't teach you anything. I mean, that only works with things like, oh, I touched the fire and I got burned, you know, but it doesn't work with things like, you know, getting your children.
Anything reasonably complicated, yeah, because it's just all confirmation bias and quirkiness of small experience. So, but it could, but it's very compelling to the individual. To her, it's case closed. You know, what she knows is one child is vaccinated, he's dead. The rest of my children are perfectly fine and they were not vaccinated. And no logic or scientific evidence will convince her that that is not a cause and effect. It's just the way we're hardwired. And now she's so emotionally invested. I mean, I agree, Jay. I mean, losing a child must be absolutely devastating. And this is how she's dealing with it. The emotional investment is also huge. It's just unfortunate that other people will be damaged because of this, because she's spreading misinformation that
damage or kill
But that, and that's the other side of the coin. Okay, so yes, I do feel bad for her and anybody in that situation. It's terrible, but you know what? She should not be writing books like this. She has no idea what she's talking about. She's spreading misinformation, and sadly, if this book gets more press, she will be responsible for kids dying or getting permanently damaged by these diseases.
And it's not just the book. Unfortunately, much like Meryl Dorey, she is trying to spread her message far and wide, which includes giving vaccination seminars around Australia. And also, like Meryl Dorey, she claims that sudden infant death syndrome isn't really a thing. It's just based on the problem is with vaccines that are causing it. Meryl Dorey also goes so far as to say that shaken baby syndrome isn't a real thing, that that's always just vaccines. She's even she even lobbied for an American man who was imprisoned for apparently beating his child to death. She campaigned for him on the idea that his child was actually killed by vaccines.
What about kids that are hurt in car accidents?
There's no car accidents either. I mean, it's all vaccines.
Right. Vaccines are somehow involved and the government is hiding it all. You know, there's a giant conspiracy.
All right. Sad story. But Bob, let's transition to a happy story about the Higgs boson.
Hooray.
Well, I might beg to differ. The big news, I think, this week was the first electronic optical fibers with hydrogenated amorphous silicon were developed. Did you know that?
Well, yeah.
Don't talk to me like that again, bud. That's number two. The number one story was that scientists discovered why buttercups reflect yellow on chins. Did you know that?
Yes, I saw that too.
Way to ruin science or fiction, Bob.
Good thing I didn't choose
that, Bob. That doesn't mean you like butter. What's up?
You do like
parquet. I'm kidding, obviously.
Who doesn't like butter?
People allergic to butter?
But don't get me started, and I can't believe it's not butter. That stuff is not butter. That will make – that is
– I can't believe
nausea
it.
Inducing.
So about that Higgs boson.
Yeah, the Higgs boson.
Yeah, so
pretty cool, huh?
So unless you've been off planet or in stasis for a couple of weeks, you probably have heard about the latest hubbub about the Higgs boson. Two separate teams of scientists at CERN using the Large Hadron Collider have found the most similar and enticing hints yet of the existence of the Higgs boson, the so-called God particle. I hate that name. The particle that is thought.
Can we call it the Lucifer particle?
I was going to go with the Thor particle.
The Buddha particle?
There you go. This is the particle that's thought to imbue all matter with mass. Now, both the ATLAS and CMS experiments and the teams that ran those experiments recently announced their results from literally, and I mean this, hundreds of trillions of proton collisions that offer not conclusive proof of Higgs, but the best evidence yet for many reasons. The Higgs boson is the last predicted particle of the famous and successful Standard Model of Physics, which describes how forces and particles interact. A key component of this theory is actually not the particle per se, which everyone seems to focus on, but the Higgs field. This is what everything really is interacting with in order to get the mass, even the Higgs particle itself. Now, as great as the standard theory is, it doesn't actually predict the mass of the Higgs. So scientists kind of need to look around at all the various energies that it could potentially exist in and exclude those energy domains where they don't find it. So you're just kind of just narrowing it down more and more over time. And it seems like they're really backing it into a corner now, if it even still exists, which of course isn't certain. Now, the ATLAS team has narrowed the range that the it looks like the Higgs exists between 115 and 131 giga electron volts. The CMS team is saying that it cannot be heavier than 127 GeV, giga electron volts. Now, you'll see electron volts tossed around a lot in a lot of these articles. It refers to an amount of energy, an electron volt. One electron volt is the amount of energy that is given to an electron when it's accelerated through an electric potential difference of one volt. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. These electron volts work very well in particle physics. They're very flexible. They can be used as a unit of momentum. And also due to E equals MC squared or energy mass equivalence, it could also be used for a unit of mass. So to kind of put these into perspective a little bit, one GeV is a billion electron volts. One TeV is a trillion electron volts, and that's about the same kinetic energy of a flying mosquito. So even a trillion electron volts is still not a lot of energy. The energy of one photon of visible light is anywhere between 1.6 to 3.4 electron volts. So very, very little energy there. So if these latest experiments are correct, and the Higgs would then weigh between about 126 billion electron volts, that would make it about 126 times heavier than a proton and a quarter million times heavier than an electron. So it would certainly be a big boy. The next question that I think of is like, well, all right, how confident are these scientists? That's pretty important. And you may have heard a lot about sigma. They give numbers, a sigma of 1.9 or 2 point whatever. These sigma numbers try to put into perspective the chance that the results are a total fluke with no significance at all. So for the ATLAS experiments, the statistical significance of the 126 GeV was a sigma of 2.3. Now that means that there's about a 2% chance of their results being just a random fluctuation. The CMS detector had a sigma of 1.9, so that was less than 2%. Now that sounds good, and it is very good, but the gold standard is 5 sigma, and that would mean that there's less than 1 in a million chance of random noise causing the results that they're seeing. So clearly there's more work to be done and more data to be gathered before we can all, you know, get drunk and really start celebrating the Higgs boson. And I don't know, did you guys find a similar puzzling attitude? A lot of people were like, oh, nothing to see here. Please move on. You know, big deal. They didn't discover it yet. And I disagree. I think there's plenty of room for real optimism in this. You know, we've been steadily narrowing the range, the energy regime in which the Higgs can be found. That alone, I think, makes these most recent results much more compelling than if the range was much larger than it was even a few years ago. So as you narrow that range down where it would most likely exist, any new evidence that you have, I think, is more compelling. Second, the standard model doesn't tell us how big the Higgs is. This one was pretty interesting, but it does tell us how it would interact with particles like the W and Z bosons, which are responsible for the weak nuclear force. So if you consider the weight of those particles, which have been determined through experiments, the Higgs should weigh between 115 and 130 giga electron volts, and that fits these latest predictions like a glove. That's exactly what they're saying, and to me, that's very compelling. And finally, for the first time, we've got these two separate high resolution experiments that both agree on this new energy range. So you put all that together. And, you know, of course, it still can be a fluke, but I think after such the long journey these guys have taken, it seems likely to me that these are among the final steps that these scientists are taking to finally determine if the Higgs exists or not, and whether it does or not. And I think we'll probably know, with a sigma of 5, hopefully within a year or so, that, I think either eventuality, I think, would be worth raising a glass to all the scientists that have worked so hard on this.
I think people have been inundated in, especially the last few years, with articles about the Higgs boson coming out every what seems like couple months. And it's kind of like the boy who cried wolf phenomenon. It's like, all right, well, you know, let us know when the wolf is really
yeah,
here.
Yeah, that's part
then
of
we'll
it.
We'll pay attention, right?
It seems like more of the same, and as interesting and as important as these results are. Yeah, after 3 or 4 times, God, I think we've talked about the Higgs on at least three or four occasions. And the LHC, forget it. We've talked about that a bunch too. So yeah, there's that part of it. I think that's might be a reason why a lot of these people are just like ho-hum. But there are certainly a lot of people that are just so excited.
This is happening. You know, we're not just going to wait and say when it's totally over. It's interesting to see the process unfold.
Yeah.
Lawrence Krauss, whose interview we aired last week, was quoted as saying this about it: "If the Higgs is discovered, it will represent perhaps one of the greatest triumphs of the human intellect in recent memory, vindicating 50 years of the building of one of the greatest theoretical edifices in all of science and requiring the building of the most complicated machine that has ever been built." So I think that puts it into perspective. This is huge, and I think we should watch it unfold and not just pop the corks at the very end and get people caught up. You know, so.
Well, I can see the general public might not be interested in the play-by-play. I find it fascinating because I like to hear the steps that they're taking. It's also good to, you know, it's good to keep that research in the press because, you know, it gives us the idea that they're right. using that machine. You know, it took so long to do it. It was so expensive. And, you know, I need to hear about updates like this. I think it's important.
I love the play-by-play because what's most fascinating is the process of science, not just the findings of science. And, you know, how they're building the case for the Higgs and what it means is just as fascinating as the end result.
Science education, at least in this country, in the U.S., isn't about teaching the process. It's not about teaching how difficult science can be and all the, you know, the amount of time and the amount of failures you have to have before you have one success. I think most people think of science as a string of large discoveries. And so they look around and they wonder why they're not seeing scientists making these big discoveries now.
Eureka!
The other cool thing about this type of research is it usually does, and we will see the LHC create more new information. Like, you know, things will be discovered and happened upon by accident that will lead to other stuff that they never even thought about.
Well, Jay, it's funny you point that out because that's exactly what's happening now. Now that they really think they've got a handle on the range in which the Higgs can appear, that would mean that the Higgs is has a very relatively low mass, which would mean, according to the standard theory, I think, that the Higgs would have to be accompanied by another particle. Now, this is a particle that's not explicitly predicted by the standard theory, but in order for the Higgs to exist at this low mass, it would need this extra particle with it. Otherwise, the Higgs would never be stable, the universe never would have existed, and things would be very different and boring all around. But so this might actually lead to new physics. Right.
An entourage.
This could lead to new physics. I mean, how awesome would that be if the last particle proven that the standard theory predicted, that we finally showed experimentally, leads the way to new physics because of this new particle that wasn't really anticipated, but would have to exist if the Higgs has that mass. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think that the standard model is one of the greatest triumphs of science. It's up there with the periodic table. Oh, yeah. I mean, evolution, some basic concept that has a huge impact. Implications for our understanding of how the world works. Some lighter news this week. Did you guys hear about the UFO that's trailing behind Mercury?
Absolutely.
You mean the cloaked UFO?
The cloaked UFO.
It can't be anything else, Steve.
No, what else could it possibly be? So,
just tell me nobody's going to commit mass suicide over it.
I can't promise you that.
No promise.
NASA produces a lot of video and other, you know, allied astronomical organizations, you know, that are producing video and pictures either from probes or telescopes or whatever. And now with the internet, a lot of this is available online. So UFO enthusiasts can pour through pictures and video looking for anomalies. And then when they see something apparently anomalous, they declare it a UFO. It's just like ghost hunters looking at photographs and video and listening to audio, and anything that strikes them as anomalous is a ghost. It's the same process of anomaly hunting. So what one UFO enthusiast who uploaded a video to YouTube under the pseudonym of Sinexter, S-I-N-X-S-T-E-R.
Sinexter.
Sinexter.
Like sinister.
Don't ask me.
With an X.
All right.
Makes it sound cool.
He uploaded the video of a coronal mass ejection from the sun, and Mercury happened to be in the background. And in the video, which we'll link to, of course, as the coronal mass ejection sort of washing across the field of view, this cluster of lights appears to the right of the bright light that is Mercury in the middle of the field. and then it fades away again as the mass ejection passes by it. So what Sinister thought this was a large cloaked vessel that was revealed by the energy of the sun, you know, washing past it. What he gives us a voiceover for the video. It's actually the sun-centered imaging package and heliosphere imager that was taking the pictures. And he says, that is definitely some sort of manufactured object. It's cylindrical on either side and has a shape in the middle. It definitely looks like a ship to me, and very obviously it's cloaked. There's really absolutely no explanation for that other than it's some sort of ship. There you go.
I buy it.
That's all the evidence I need.
Very
compelling argument.
Now, two cylinders with a shape in the middle. So is that the Enterprise? I mean, what does he think that he is seeing there? Maybe a Romulan bird of prey, or which would make more sense because they have the cloaking device.
Yeah.
And he sounds very sincere. I mean, you never know if with things like this if it's being satirical or it's a joke, but the guy sounds sincere for whatever that's worth. But it is interesting the confidence that people can have. Essentially, you're looking at blobs of light on a video that has undergone a tremendous amount of processing. And he's convinced it has to be manufactured, it has to be a ship, and it's obviously cloaked from just these blobs of light on this video. Interestingly, which is often the case, there's already an explanation available for this. Astronomers involved with this project, this specifically Nathan Rich, was quoted as saying, it's a complicated effect. It's basically the background that is removed from the image to bring out the faint coronal signal. It's a negative imprint on the background. So what he's saying is, it's a photographic artifact. They have to remove all of the brighter objects in the background in order to see this very faint coronal mass ejection. And this is an artifact of that process. It's essentially a ghost of Mercury itself.
Right.
As Mercury's moving through the field, you know, its image was imperfectly removed from the background, leaving this ghost image behind on a couple frames.
Steve, I found another quote from Nathan Rich. Now, this guy's the ground systems engineer for the Sun-Earth Connection Coronal and Heliospheric Investigation. Seems like he knows what he's talking about. He said that, kind of like what you said, in essence, the alien image is a visual after effect or ghost artifact of Mercury. But he concludes by saying that that was photographed the previous day. So he says it's a byproduct of the way the images are made, but I'm just trying to wrap my head around what he meant by a ghost artifact of Mercury that was photographed the previous day.
I guess using cumulative images, you know, not just one image, in order to remove this background. It's not like they're just taking a snapshot. They're collecting data and processing it over a long period of time. It reminded me of the Elenin UFO, Elenin comet. Remember this, guys?
No, what was that?
We talked about it
in the TAM, where there was, again, like these cylinders trailing behind like ships in formation or something trailing behind the comet. But it was just an artifact of the fact that the camera was tracking the comet, which is moving relative to the background stars. And so the background stars were smearing out and you know, trailing behind the comet. Pure photographic artifact. But it's, you know, that this is a common scenario where the UFO enthusiasts assume that whatever they're looking at is exactly what it is. They take it completely at face value, and they don't consider photographic artifact in their, you know, thinking about it. They're just not on the list of things that they think about, or they just dismiss it out of hand.
It reminds me of visual perception in general. I mean, your eye and your brain, it's not just a camera. Your brain is constructing reality. So you can't take what you see as something that's exactly reflects reality. You just can't do it.
And it's also interesting to point out the process of anomaly hunting as a method of pseudoscience, you know, just looking for anything weird. And then rather than using that as a starting point for a hypothesis, they use that as support for a conclusion, as if this confirms that it's a ship, you know, not, oh, I don't know what's causing that. Let me figure out if anyone knows what's causing it. And let's see, you know, what if we could figure out what is the ultimate cause, rather than, ooh, that's weird, it's a ghost or it's a UFO. They short-circuit the entire process of scientific discovery. One more news item. Evan, you sent this one to me. This is about people who are able to hallucinate color at will. What the researchers found is that about 10% of the population are highly susceptible to hypnosis. About 10% of the population is resistant to hypnosis. And 80%, most people, are somewhat susceptible to hypnosis. We've talked about hypnosis in the past. It's a state of mind in which you're actually highly alert. You're highly suggestible. And it's easy to slip information past you. Some people, their brains just seem to be wired differently, so that just being suggested something seems to take on a reality to them more so than the average person. So when I imagine something, I know that what I'm imagining is not real, but some people don't know that what they're imagining is not real, just because the way their brain is not distinguishing between the two. So what the researchers found is that in a susceptible population, people who were found to be susceptible to hypnosis, if they were asked to look at a grayscale, a black and white scene, and to imagine the color of objects in that scene, they reported, yes, I can see colors. But which is, you know, interesting, but just reporting what they're seeing, we can't know if they're just saying that they're seeing it or if they're experiencing anything different than other people. So they were examined with functional MRI scanning, and what the researchers found was that parts of the brain that are involved with color perception became active, just as if they were looking at color.
I love fMRI.
Yeah.
It's fMRI tricky. I always got a little caveat in there. fMRI is tricky. And, you know, I'd like to see these kind of studies replicated before we take it totally seriously. But this, you know, it seems like their methods were reasonable, and this is in line with what's previously been described. But further, these people were able to do this spontaneously, even without being hypnotized. So, which again does suggest that their brains are just wired differently. They don't inhibit, I guess, their imagination. Or their brain experiences the same kind of processing just from thinking about something as if they were actually experiencing it with very little provocation. They don't even need to be hypnotized. They can perhaps they hypnotize themselves, or again, they're sort of always in this mode, or can slip into it voluntarily.
Wow. Now, Steve, I couldn't help thinking when I read this that that people essentially hallucinate color every night in their dreams. I mean, something that we're seems like we're built for it, or maybe I should say we've evolved for it. But I mean, this is something that maybe not as extraordinary as you may think. But what relationship do you see between dreaming in color, like everybody really does, and these people? Is it?
Oh, we're in dreams. We're seeing things, experiencing emotions, feeling things, hearing things. Right, we're having a full sensory experience. It doesn't feel the same way as our wake. Because not the brain's not working the same way. Different parts of the brain are active. But you're right. It is a completely internally created experience.
I'm sure if you did an fMRI on somebody dreaming, that the color parts of the brain would also light up, as other parts I know
right.
light up that as you're doing things, even physical
yeah.
things.
But the question you raised is what these people are doing related in any way to
yeah.
the phenomenon of dreaming, and I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
And I don't know that the answer is known. It seems that there may be some overlap, but not necessarily. It could be because dreaming is its own thing. You know, it's its own
yeah.
very specifically evolved neurological process that has pathways that are dedicated to, you know, being asleep, going through a sleep cycle, going through REM sleep, you know, through dream sleep. But it does indicate that the brain is capable of generating internal experiences. And that the you know when we dream we see red, or we actually see red, or we imagine seeing red, the same parts of the brain that relate to seeing red are activated, but it's maybe how it's interacting with other parts of the brain that make it seem like a dream or seem real or seem like imagination. And maybe that's that distinction is what's breaking down in these people, or maybe just is not there, or is there to a lesser degree, or some other pathway in the brain is able to, you know, produce an experience that's more realistic.
And that's what makes illusion so fascinating, because it's evidence,
right.
It's proof of the brain screwing up, trying to construct reality for you. And that's why they're so striking, because the brain's like, oh, I don't know how to handle this. Whoops. You know, when you like something, you see the classical illusions that your brain is just like, doesn't know what to do.
It also means that from a theoretical point of view, the matrix should work. You should be able to, you know, plug someone's brain into a computer and produce a completely full, realistic experience that is only exists virtually in the computer.
As long Nobody as, tell the computers.
Right.
Let's do it.
I can't think of any theoretical reason why that wouldn't completely work if you know, the interaction, the neuro computer interface was sophisticated enough.
Yeah, but if you were born and raised in that tube, there's no getting out.
Yeah, right.
Because
right,
there'd right. be no muscle for you to walk
yeah.
around and do anything.
Yeah, they kind of had to work around that in the movie. You know,
Well, they could have artificial muscle twitching and all that stuff. You know,
there'd be no need to keep your muscles active. If you're born, live, and die in those. Those little
floating in a tub.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, but you know, you have to have healthy cardiovascular system, and your heart has to be in shape, and all that stuff. You can't just not move.
Sure, I mean, if you're a quadriplegic, you lead a full life. You can't move anything. It's just that your muscle is not just wasted away after a certain period of time. It's literally gone. There's no coming back because there's nothing to come back. And that was just something that struck me. For those Matrix movies, is that there's no way he's going to get out of that damn thing because there's no muscle to rejuvenate or to fix or.
Steve, I have a question for you. When we dream, do we have any idea at what quality the dream is actually in? You know, sometimes when I dream, there seems to be quality differences, but at its most vivid, do you think our dreams are as vivid as what we see in here when we're wide awake?
It's hard to say. Sometimes it seems that way.
It sure does. I've had lucid dreams, Jay. We've talked about this many times, where lucid dreams are dreams in which you actually realize that you're dreaming and you're in bed and you're unconscious and everything you see and everyone you talk to is just a construct of your mind. I've had lucid dreams where I would just sit and just marvel at, say, the way I remember seeing my brother Joe in the dream and looking at his face and just thinking how realistic it looked and you know, feeling wood and knocking it and listening to the echo. So I think the more lucid you are, the more aware you are.
That's something else, Bob.
The more, you get your minds out of the gutter. The more lucid you are in the dream, I think, Jay, it's so close, it's ridiculous.
What was that? I didn't hear anything after the word wood.
But here's the problem.
Something about
when you're in the dream experiencing it, it seems real. It seems realistic, and I've marveled at how realistic it feels as well. But then your memory of it doesn't feel that way. So the problem is that you're assessing the experience with the brain activity that you have at the time. Your dream self is evaluating your dreams, and it seems real to
right.
your dream self. But then your waking self remembers the experience, and it seems dreamlike. It seems fake. It seems not real. And I think that that's because your dream self and your waking self are different, because the brain's functioning differently in those two states. Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Hey, thanks for reminding me, Steve.
I know you're very forgetful.
Jay, I noticed you didn't remind me, so no thanks to you.
Remind you about what?
That it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Who's That What Now?
Of course it is.
You shot who in the what now? All right, let's play last week's Who's That Noisy.
Oh my God, that sounded so ridiculous.
And what is it?
Well, those are piranhas, and they are communicating underwater with sound. And this is based on new research. Scientists have discovered that the fearsome fish use sounds to communicate.
Cool.
Intimidating their rivals rather than attacking. So I guess they try to, like other animals, ward them off first before the actual confrontation takes place. Specifically the red-bellied piranhas,
red-bellied
I should
piranha.
Say. This particular recording was red-bellied piranhas. And, you know, if you think about it, I think it makes perfect sense. I'll bet you they're fish communicate all the time.
Well, water is a good medium for sound, so it makes sense that a lot of creatures that live in the sea would communicate by sound.
And someone did guess correctly. From the message boards, I am a elephant, apparently a Republican.
No, maybe it's actually a pachyderm.
Oh, okay.
Could be. Wait, and is it actually a elephant?
I am a elephant.
Oh, that just hurts. That hurts me in my heart.
Thanks to listener Nicole Thornsbury from Ann Arbor, Michigan, for sending in last week's Who's That Noisy About the Piranha Bark. Thanks again, Nicole.
And what do you got for this week?
This week, something a little bit different. Here we go. Who's That Noisy?
Wow, no idea.
Interesting.
You have to pay attention not only what you're hearing, but how you're hearing it. Maybe that makes sense, and maybe it doesn't, but there's a little clue for you. And I think, based on that, someone might be able to actually guess this one correctly. So, put on your thinking caps. And there was a question last week as to where people can send their answers for.
Oh, I thought you were going to say where people can get their thinking caps.
That'll be on next week's show.
Rebecca, do we sell thinking caps at the store?
That's a good...
Not yet, but...
Good idea.
What? It's okay. On the list.
It is now. So,
yep.
info@theskepticsguide.org is our email address, or you can go to the message boards, as I Am a Elephant did. Let us know your guess there. First one to guess correctly is the winner. Good luck to everybody.
Thanks, Evan. So we have been debuting a new segment on the SGU. Every week, Jay will throw some common myth into the conversation, and then the listeners have to figure out what that myth is and email us, and then we'll correct the myth the following week.
That's been really
I like
popular
this segment. Yeah.
So far.
Yep, that's right. The research for me has been incredible.
And you only need to use 10% of your brain to do it.
That's right.
It's awesome.
This is the third week for this segment. I think it's working really well.
Uh-huh.
So
I'm glad that you appreciate it, Steve, and I'm glad that the audience has been appreciating it as well.
Why don't you tell us what
Well, Barbara wins this week for picking out the myth that Jay threw into last week's show. She writes, I was listening to the latest podcast, reached the Fact or Fiction, it's science or fiction, segment of the program and was disappointed to hear Jay trot out that old newage lady togetherness myth about women's periods syncing up. It's one of those things people say, like, Betty and I are such good friends, we even have periods at the same time. It's also bullshit. Socially synchronizing periods do not exist, and because of the varying lengths of duration of the period itself, along with time between, cycles that start out apparently synced will uncouple over time. There are only so many days in a general 4 to 6 week cycle. Chances are, at some point, one of my roommates and I will sort of sync for a month or three, but not the whole length of the apartment's lease. And while this myth persists, even it has never had the ovarian fortitude to claim syncing roommates have periods the exact same duration. Two, as cycles unsync, people will start to count the near misses as evidence. First, it will be on the same day, then only 2 days apart, then four, etc. Why, we must still be in sync, even though clearly they're slowly getting further and further apart. No reputable, repeatable study has ever proved syncing cycles. So...
Yeah.
Jay sort of threw this out as sort of in his thought process during Science or Fiction last week. This brings up a few broader points before we get to the specific point of do menstrual cycles sync up or not. That
broader.
This is something that really hit home for me when I was in medical school, how chock full my head is of misinformation and myths. That you just part of the culture, you pick it up over time, and then you know if you make any in-depth methodical study of any one topic, all of the myths you have about that topic get beaten out of you over time. But what's important to do, in my opinion, is that you extrapolate from that experience to the fact that, well, you know, my head is filled with as much misinformation and mythology about everything else that I haven't studied extensively. Of course, this podcast has been part of that process as well. You know, here every week we're talking about a lot of things. You know, every now and then we come out with something that we think we remember or is just part of the culture. And, you know, we have thousands of people who crowdsource it for us. So a lot of the things that we say that are incorrect, that we obviously try to vet them beforehand, but the show's unscripted and sometimes things slip through the cracks. So it's great to be able to come back to them and point them out. So with regard to menstrual cycles syncing, Harriet Hall wrote a great article about it on Science-Based Medicine. Menstrual synchrony, do girls who go together flow together?
Wow.
I wrote about this in September of this year.
She has a way with words.
She does. Very good. And she points out a lot of...
She doesn't beat around the bush.
A lot of the same...
That's enough.
A lot of the same points that Barbara made that. Yeah, menstrual cycles are of varying lengths. So it would be very difficult, impossible, to completely synchronize menstrual cycles that have different lengths. They would also have to adjust their duration so that they were the same. And with a essentially, you know, 5 to 7 days, 7 day menstrual cycle occurring every 4 to 5, 6 weeks, there's going to be a lot of overlap or near overlap just by chance alone. It reminded me of, was it Phil Plait who made the joke that, yeah, an earthquake will occur within 2 weeks of a full or new moon.
Yeah, classic.
So it's just similar, very, very similar thing. So certainly that could create the impression of synchronization even when it doesn't exist. In terms of the scientific literature, the review of the literature is mixed. Some studies claim to show a tendency towards synchronization. Others do not. It seems that the studies that show that there is no synchronization on the average may be a little bit more rigorous than the ones that purport to do. There certainly is no consensus, scientific consensus, that there is the phenomenon of synchronization. A lot of hand-waving explanations are offered as to why women would or would not synchronize, and there's really no science behind that at all. Synchronization has not been shown in chimpanzees or other mammals that were studied. And also, there's no evidence that human pheromones exist. Pheromones definitely exist in some other animal species that have been studied, but they've never been clearly shown to exist in humans. And that's often offered as how that happens, that women send, you know, hormonal signals to each other, and that's how they synchronize their menstrual cycle.
Steve?
Yeah?
Would you like this week's myth?
Sure. What is it?
All right, well, I'll present it in the form of a question to see what you guys know. What does searing meat do, or why do people sear meat?
Keep the juices in?
By searing meat, you mean like just cook it very, like for a few seconds on either side?
Yeah, you sear it, so you're basically browning the outside.
I don't know.
The fact behind it is that it actually could cause more moisture to leave the meat. And it does not seal in the juices in any way. The reason why meat is seared is for a flavor enhancement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Has nothing to do with the moisture. And I could not believe when I read that was wrong. I was wrong all this time.
Wow.
I mean, I must have said it hundreds of times in my life to people all over the place about how to cook meat. Why do we cook meat in a iron skillet? And the reason why we sear it, but it's not for sealing in juices. It doesn't do that.
But Jay, you're going to do another segment of Swindler's List, and you're going to try very hard not to create any myths in the process.
I'm going to try my damnedest, Steve. This segment of Swindler's List is about online dating. Notice how quiet it gets. Everybody's embarrassed about this. People don't
I'm
like
not
to
embarrassed.
Admit.
I did online dating for a while. I got
How'd
so much
go?
Tail.
So you have some stories yourself, Rebecca.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I did try online dating, and I have some very... very interesting anecdotes, but let me hit you with the facts first, and then we'll go into some personal experiences later. What's been happening over the past several years is a dramatic increase in people getting scammed while visiting online dating sites. Now, without getting into right now the validity of the actual sites and those businesses, this is more of a warning about things that happen to people when they're on these sites by other people looking or supposedly looking for a partner. Here's the basic scam. The scam goes like this. Person goes on, creates a profile, and at that point opens themselves up to receive solicitation from other people on these websites. And what ends up happening to most people is that, you know, depending on the quality of their profile and how much time they spend on it and, you know, are they creepy or not, they'll get, you know, some responses and may meet people or whatever. But what unfortunately happens to a percentage of the people that go on is they get targeted to be scammed. And the scam works like this. they get contacted, and this, of course, there's infinite variation in this, but I'm giving you one of the most common scenarios. They get contacted by someone on the site, typically have attractive pictures on their profile. That person, the person receiving the message responds, and very quickly they're asked to start communicating off of that dating site. Like, you know, let's go on, you know, let's communicate over Gmail, or let's chat, or let's get on AIM and we'll chat with each other or whatever. But they get off the dating site as quickly as possible. And the reason being is that they want these profiles up for as short amount of time as they can, because first of all, that costs them money. And second of all, it makes it so they're covering their tracks as quickly as possible. The scammer then does the best job that they can to convince their target that they're interested, that they have a lot of common, that, you know, they sometimes will be known to actually send people presents and things like that to soften them up. Now keep in mind, they're doing this to as many people as they can at the same time. So they basically get in, they hit as many targets as they can, they work them off of the site, you know, off of the dating site as best they can. And they will do this up to, that I've read, I've seen people actually be in these, in this wooing stage for up to 6 months. People have reported having a scam artist try to trick them and, you know, build trust with them. Now, of course, you know, there's a lot of different ways that people could be taken advantage of. The problem is that most of these scammers are not in the United States. They're from other countries. What they're trying to do is get them to do one of a handful of things, typically revolving around money. One of the common things would be that the scammer would send presents and finally soften the person up to where they really, you know, are having a lot of feelings for this fake person that they've created. And they have people just send them money. Money for lots of different things, like, my boss didn't give me a paycheck this week and I wanted to buy an airline ticket to come see you. You know, maybe you can loan me the money and I'll pay you back. Or they'll say, I'm having visa problems. Or they'll use a number of different avenues to get money out of that person. And they go as far as even using their target as a way to launder money that they're stealing from other people, which I found very, very interesting. So that scenario would go something like this. They would have a stolen credit card. They would send either goods to their target, or they would, you know, basically take a cash allowance or whatever. And then they have that person send them either the packages that they sent them or forward them money or transfer money to them that they transferred into the target's account. And that launders the money for them. And did you know, guys, that if this happens to you, you are financially responsible for that money? That's the law. You, regardless of whether you know it or not, you're responsible for it. And most credit cards don't even protect you against this type of activity. From the research that I did, a lot of people that were reporting things like this happening, I mean, these scams were starting in the $10,000 range. And, you know, the deeper in that these people get emotionally, and the more that they feel a connection and these fake relationships that are being formed, the obviously the more money they're willing to give. And a lot of times people, it takes them a lot. It takes quite a bit of an event to even get them to believe, well after they've lost their money, that it's fake, because they can't believe it because of these relationships that they've made. And, you know, I'm sure that a lot of people here, especially with Twitter and with Facebook and everything, you know, have developed a lot of strong relationships with people that they've never met over Facebook. I mean, I have tons of friends online that I've either met once or never met, and I have great relationships, a lot of fun and actually sincerity and a lot of honesty and things that would be happening with people I've never met. And, you know, for someone that's deliberately trying to scam someone who is lonely and is, you know, putting themselves out there and definitely wanting to meet someone, it's actually not that hard for these scammers to get on the inside of people emotionally, and then they just completely take advantage of them. And there's so little recourse here. There's almost nothing that can be done about it. And the country that keeps coming up the most that I read in the research that I did was Nigeria.
Yeah.
Once again, the Nigerian strike. So a lot of the red flags that people will encounter is, first of all, the person does pivot them off of the dating site right away. Another thing that happens is that they start getting very intimate very fast. You know, a lot of people were reporting that the scammers were saying things like they loved them and all that. Very quickly, you know, within a day or two, they start getting very personal. They start using pet names very quickly. They don't have a lot to say about themselves and are focusing on the target. And as much as that might stroke all of our egos when someone's asking us a lot of questions and fascinated about us and our lives and everything, you got to always be very careful and ask the other person, of course, revealing questions. And a lot of the people stated that they remember the scammers actually making mistakes about pieces of information that they gave them. So where they would ask the same question a couple of times and they would get multiple answers. The scammers also a lot of times can't type English very well or don't get common English phrases, or they repeat themselves, which the repeating themselves thing means that they're not remembering all the dialogue that they had because they're doing this to multiple people at the same time. So you'll find like a very strange disconnect mixed in with all of the fake intimacy that's going on, where, you know, the people will experience things that they kept saying. You know, I felt like I was talking to them, but it felt like whenever it turned around on them, there was no consistency, or they kept asking me the same questions or whatever. There was a lot of repeat stuff.
And this is like all of the most successful scams, there's a built-in reason why people won't be reporting them, because it's depressing and embarrassing, you know, to realize that this person that you thought you were in love with and was in love with you is actually just trying to scam you. That's the sort of thing I think most people would just sort of hide away so it doesn't even get reported.
Overall, though, I don't think the online dating thing is a complete and total waste of time. I think if you're looking for someone and you want to use the internet to meet people, sure, you could do this as one avenue, but I still think face-to-face going out, you know, in my opinion, one of the best things you could do is go to like meetup.com, find common interests, you know, find groups of people that do things that you like to do, or, you know, pick up some new hobbies, but go out and meet people in person. That works better than anything else.
I got a scam email today because I am searching for a new apartment on Craigslist, and I found one that was too good to be true, and sure enough, it was.
So what was the scam?
It's a pretty common thing. If you've ever been on Craigslist, you've seen it. It's an ad for, in this case, it could be for anything. In this case, it's an apartment, and it was a good couple of $100s less than what other comparable apartments were in that area. And I emailed saying, hey, I'm interested. Could I come take a look at it? And I got a response saying, first of all, that was like,
I need your bank account.
All bold and in like 18 point font and capital letters, and very good to hear from you. And I have just won, what did he call it? Petroleum land in Nigeria.
Oh, that's not a scam.
My wife and I must leave. And so you must take care of the house, and that's why the rent is so cheap. Please fill out this application, and you know, you can drive by and look at the exterior. thank you very much. God bless. So, of course, I filled out the application.
Yep. Volunteered some extra information.
He didn't double check the phone number and stuff because it was the local police department's phone number, and as was the address. And I said that the reason why I was moving was because I needed more space for my four new dogs and my meth lab. And he got back to me saying, congratulations, application approved. And,
oh, that was easy.
And he gave me
so the four dogs didn't scare him off.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I was worried because some landlords don't like pets, but yeah, he was okay.
They love meth though.
Oh, I also said that there'd be seven people living in the apartment, which included my security. But yeah, he approved my application and he gave me details on where I could send the money. And
great.
So that was a couple of hours ago, and I responded and asked him when I could see the interior of the apartment and would it be okay if one of the bedrooms is used as a meth lab. Some landlords have a problem with that, but I assured him that I've been studying by watching Breaking Bad and staring at my periodic table shower curtain. So I haven't heard back from him yet, but fingers crossed.
Oh my God. It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to sniff out the fake. Is everyone ready?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Pick up the gauntlet.
Recovered from your sweep last week? Just saying. Here we go. Item number one. Scientists have successfully developed a vaccine against breast cancer that has been shown to be effective in mice. Item number two, scientists have developed a plant spray that allows plants to survive freezing conditions unharmed. And item number three, psychologists discover that adding a small gift to a larger gift decreases the gift evaluation of the recipient. Evan, go first.
Developing a vaccine against breast cancer that has been shown to be effective in mice. Vaccine against cancer. I'm drawing a blank as to precedent for this. Vaccines against cancer. Is that something I should be aware of, or would this be a first? I wonder what the anti-vax crowd thinks about this. The next one. So, some scientist somewhere developed a plant spray, allowing them to survive freezing conditions unharmed. A plant spray. I suppose that's certainly plausible. Whether they've actually done it or not, I guess we will find out. Now, the psychologists discovering adding a small gift to a larger one decreases gift evaluation of the recipient. Decreases the gift of evaluation of the recipient.
Do you want me to explain that?
Is that overall or just of the larger one?
Yeah, overall. So if you give somebody a big gift compared to that exact same big gift plus a small gift on the side, they think the package is less with the small gift, even though it's additional to the big gift.
I mean, Jesus, this is tremendously subjective, which doesn't mean that it's not true. Because what with psychological factors and whatnots?
Well, the Christmas coming and all.
Yeah, what with Christmas coming and all? I actually think that of the three, this one's probably the most true, if that's even possible. Therefore, it's down to the vaccine against breast cancer or the plant spray. Now, all right, I'm going to say vaccine against breast cancer. That one's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
The one about scientists developing a vaccine for breast cancer that is effective in mice. When I think about being vaccinated against a certain type of cancer, that's really interesting, and I've never heard of that before. I mean, hopefully I'm not completely blowing it on this one. I don't think I've heard of any kind of vaccination against any kind of cancer even being studied. But that is interesting, and I don't see why that wouldn't work. The only thing is that mice would have very small breasts, and that'd be probably very hard to work with.
To put them in the little tiny mammogram machine.
Yeah, like how do they do that? How do they even know they have cancer, Steve? Come on, they don't have mammogram machines that small.
Yeah, Steve.
Unless the mice built their own equipment, Rebecca.
It's true. They have tiny little paws.
They could do it. All right, I definitely believe in that one now. So that's the second one about like this plant spray that allows plants to survive freezing conditions. I get two different ideas here. One is that the spray stops the plant from freezing, which I think is much more likely than the spray allows the plant to freeze, but you know, gives it some type of vitality there. And sure, you know, plant cells, I could possibly see them having some type of antifreeze type of thing that keeps them from freezing. The only thing is most plants, you know, have a lot of water in them. You know, like when you say plants as well, that's very generic. Like plants could be anything. There's a huge variation in plants.
Anything that's a plant, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you say plant spray. They even call it plant spray. I don't know. That one's a little vague for me. I don't like it. That's definitely on the list.
Definitely the top three.
Then finally, the last one about giving people a small gift and a larger gift, and it changes the perception of the gift evaluation. You know, putting myself in that scenario, someone gets me an awesome brand new, like $5,000, like 70-inch TV, and then they buy me, I don't know, a Matchbox car. I'm still damn excited about that TV, but that's, you know, that's just me. I'm going to say that the plant spray is the fake. Thank you.
Okay, Bob.
Start with three. The gift one. Yeah, that just makes so much sense. I can't help but think about, you know, do you want the good news or the bad news? You want the good news first, right? If you had the bad news first, it would kind of, you know, attenuate the good feelings you'd get on the good news. So yeah, that just makes a hell of a lot of sense to me. The plant spray. Yeah, I could see something, some sort of cryoprotectant, something that would help the plant keep the heat in.
Nano coating.
Survive freezing conditions unharmed. Yeah, I mean, I can kind of see that one too. The first one, I've got a problem with the whole idea of a vaccine against breast cancer. I mean, what do you got, these little, like what, dead cancer cells that your body would build an immune response against? I would think you would need some sort of genetic engineering at some level to treat breast cancer. And not just some kind of vaccine. It just seems, you know, kind of obvious. But so what the hell? I'm going to go with the vaccine one. It's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Damn. That was the only one that I thought was science, actually. And I don't think it needs to be a vaccine that's made of dead cancer cells, necessarily. I think it would just need to be something that could train the body's immune system to attack cancer cells.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't necessarily have to be done that way. So for me, it's between the plant spray and the gift thing. I like the gift thing. The gift thing is a cool bit of psychology, if true. And like Bob said, it does make a lot of sense. Everything is relative, and we can change our opinions of something based on something that may seem inconsequential when you're outside of the actual experience. So that leaves me with the plant spray thing. I don't know anything about it. I don't know. You don't say anything here about the spray itself causing cancer in lab rats. So, I mean, it's possible that there's a spray that keeps the plants just fine through freezing conditions, but I don't know. I don't like it as much as the other one, so that's the reason why I'm going to say that one's the fiction.
Okay. Well, you guys are split then, so Rebecca and Jay think that the plant spray is fiction, and Evan and Bob think that the vaccine against cancer is fiction. You all think that number three is science, that psychologists discover that adding a small gift to a larger gift decreases the gift evaluation of the recipient. This is my Christmas question, or my holiday question.
Yeah.
And that one is
science.
Cool.
Yeah, but it's cool. You're all safe so far. This is the paradox of gift giving. And it's different. It stems from a difference in how the gift giver and the gift receiver evaluate gifts. Gift giver will tend to think that you know, adding a little gift to a larger gift is like the icing on the cake. There's a little something extra. $500 on a good gift, and here's a $50 gift in addition to it, that only makes it better. But the gift receiver, they sort of average out the value of the two gifts and evaluate the whole package. So you're just dragging down the average with the cheap gift. It makes no rational sense.
Sounds like an accounting trick.
That's crazy, Steve. What, you can't? So you can only get somebody an expensive gift. That's
well,
what you're saying?
Well, if you believe this research, don't sully an expensive gift with a cheap gift.
Yeah, just get the cheap gift.
Right.
Save yourself a lot of money.
What about the idea that you're getting someone a bunch of gifts, like Christmas, you know?
Just presenting the results of the research. What can I tell you?
So you have no opinion whatsoever.
Well, I don't know if there's a limit to the number of gifts, how it affects this paradox, this effect. That's a very good question that was not discussed in this article, right? If you give 10 gifts, are they still averaging it out? Does the number of gifts eventually have an independent effect on...
Not if they're Americans, because Americans are terrible at math. Once you hit 10 gifts, it's just too difficult.
I also wonder if it's giving gifts at the exact same time, right? You have a large and a small, like, side by side. Or if you get, like, the large one first, and then an hour later you get the small one. If timing has something to do with it.
They also, the researchers said this is part of a more general phenomenon that does not only apply to gift giving. People who present a bundle of information, you know, assume that every piece of information will be evaluated in and of itself, when in fact the recipient tends to evaluate the package in sort of an averaging type of process. So that was interesting. So don't add the little gift to the big gift this holiday season. Let's go back to number one. Scientists have successfully developed a vaccine against breast cancer that has been shown to be effective in mice.
I like the little gifts.
Bob and Evan, you think this one is fiction.
It's ridiculous.
And this one is science. Yeah. Sorry, guys.
Aha!
Which one was science?
The breast cancer and vaccine.
We won, Jay. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Rebecca, do it.
All right. The virtual.
I know who's getting small gifts this year.
The virtual high five.
We won, and scientists are going to cure breast cancer.
Everybody wins.
Vaccinations. Anti-vaxxers, come on.
Except the anti-vaxxers.
Rally against this one.
That's true, yeah.
Crazy people.
So what the vaccine is against is a complex carbohydrate called MUC1. It's found on more than 70% of all cancers, and it's highly expressed in those cancers, more so than in normal cells, which means that they would be more susceptible to this. Now, the vaccine has three components. One component stimulates the production of antibodies. The other component stimulates the production of lymphocytes. So you need both humoral and cellular immunity. And then a third component targets this MUC1. Without all three components, the vaccine is not effective. And this essentially targets the immune system against the cancer cells. They are thinking that this may be a good option if it pans out in human trials, which can start as early as next year, that this could be effective for adjunctive therapy to prevent recurrence of breast cancer. It could be effective against cancers that are not highly responsive to chemotherapy. Breast cancers have different kinds of receptors on them, and the presence of those receptors make them vulnerable to certain kinds of chemotherapy. So-called triple-negative breast cancers are highly resistant to chemotherapy, and therefore having an option like this would be very useful and certainly very much needed for those types of cancers. 35,000 patients a year are diagnosed with triple-negative breast cancer. Those are the hardest to treat. Or for breast cancer that does not require surgery, or for whatever reason where surgery is either not desired or not an option, this would be another way to try to shrink the tumor.
Cool.
You know, we don't throw around the word cure. It's just one more treatment option in the armamentarium, and combined with other treatments may, you know, further increase survival, decrease recurrence, etc. So hopefully it will pan out. It's a completely novel approach, you know, compared to the treatments that are currently available. It's a great idea. It would be, if it does pan out, the first successful vaccine against a cancer. Right now, the only vaccine that actually reduces the incidence of cancer is, anybody know? Is the HPV vaccine.
Oh, duh. Oh,
right.
Because, the human papillomavirus can cause cervical cancer. So the vaccine against the virus prevents decreases the incidence of cancer. But this would be the first one that would be directly against a cancer itself. And this might also, because this MUC1, again, is expressed on many different types of cancer, like pancreatic, ovarian, and multiple myeloma, it might potentially have effectiveness against all of those cancers. So it might be broadly applicable, not just to breast cancer.
That'd be cool.
I hope so. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, so it's a pretty exciting avenue of research. Again, years away from an implementation, but hopefully this approach will pan out. Which means that scientists have developed a plant spray that allows plants to survive freezing conditions unharmed is fiction. So they did develop a spray, a foliar framing. You spray it on the leaves of the plant itself. And what it does is it allows the plant to tolerate colder temperatures, a colder climate. It's essentially like shifting down one zone. You know, there's the hardiness zones that plants can survive in. Or the example was given that the plant was located 200 miles to the south of its actual location. Essentially, it can tolerate a decrease of a couple of degrees Celsius. But
how does it work?
It's a cryoprotectant, essentially. It makes the plants hardier against the effects of cold, but does not protect against freezing. Freezing is still going to cause damage to the plants, which is still could, you know, again, that you're increasing the zone in which you can plant certain crops by up to a couple of hundred miles to the north, essentially. That could be potentially significant. And they claim that the spray is completely environmentally and plant-friendly and healthy, and there's no hazards to it. It's completely non-toxic. We always have to, you know, wait and see if that's really the case, but that's what they're claiming. I thought that was interesting. I am actually trying to grow a couple of banana plants in my basement. I wonder if this...
That's illegal.
Yeah. What do you mean it's illegal?
Is that a banana plant in your basement?
I have two banana plants in my basement.
Cops are going to see those grow lamps, and they're going to come after
you. Just happy to see me.
We'll see. I don't know if they're going to survive the winter. Hope, just crossing my fingers, hoping for the best. So congratulations, Jay and Rebecca.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
Bob, going...
That's good work, Rebecca.
Going through a little bit of a rough patch
there,
Bob.
Jay.
The whole damn year's been a rough patch. What the hell?
Yeah.
Bob, who are you talking to?
I'm comparing myself to myself, not to you. That would be kind of silly.
The way I look at it is I've been having a good year.
Ouch.
That's how I look at it. But we'll see. Maybe we'll go over the stats in a couple of weeks for our year-end wrap-up episode.
Let's skip that this year.
No, I think it'll be good. Go through some stats. But before that, Jay, you owe us a quote for the week.
A listener named Richard Brorson, who lives in Malmo, Sweden, which happens to be the most visited European place I've ever been to in my life. I go to Malmo, Sweden all the time. So maybe one time Richard and I will hook up next time
it's
I go.
It's most visited by you? Is that
yes,
what you meant?
Me.
Not generally most visited.
No, absolutely not in general. Me. When I get on an airplane, I'm most likely going to Malmo, Sweden.
Yeah.
Anyway, he sent a very interesting quote, and I wanted to read it for you. So the quote is, Every existing thing is born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance. Anybody care to guess who said that?
Nietzsche.
Pee Wee Herman.
Some French guy.
I'll read the author's bio, and then you tell me who you think it is. Was a French existentialist philosopher, playwright, novelist, screenwriter, political activist, biographer, and literary critic.
Is it Jean-Paul
Pepe Le Pew?
Sartre. I never know how to pronounce this name. That's why I didn't.
Jean-Paul Charles Aimard Sartre.
Whoa.
Sartre. All right. Thanks, Jay.
I love yelling.
Yelling is good for the soul. Do you know the human head weighs 8 pounds?
Is there? Yep, is that the myth of the week?
See if the listeners
identify that. One final note this week. We learned of the death of Christopher Hitchens after we recorded the show for this week. So I wanted to make quick mention of that. He died on December 15th. We will, however, talk extensively about Christopher Hitchens on next week's show. All right, guys. Thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Sure.
Yeah, is it right to let whole science fiction?
Yeah. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune or your portal of choice.